Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters Show with your host, Joel Zeslavsky. When's the last time you walked on a frozen lake in the wintertime? If you've never done it, and I don't mean to sound like Dr. Evil, it's breathtaking. I suggest you try it. This is episode number 14. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Smart and Simple Matters Show, folks. This one is going to have a special flavor to it because I'll be chatting with a man who knows curating like a duck knows water. But it's going to be much more than just another installment of our curating series on the Smart and Simple Matters Show. I'm pumped up to have Steve Rosenbaum with me today. My apologies if I struggle to introduce him properly, because it's not easy to introduce a man who has done such cool stuff and continues to do really cool stuff. Steve is an author of a popular book called Curation Nation, is a consumer, creator, and curator of a lot of video content, like his TEDx talk in Grand Rapids, and has been granted the title of Entrepreneur at Large for New York City's Economic Development Corporation. The story behind that one is pretty sweet, but that, of course, is not all. Steve is also the CEO of Magnify.net, a leading provider of cloud-based video curation solutions for publishers, brands, and ad networks. When he's not building his own platform, he is contributing to websites like the Huffington Post, Mashable, and other prominent places. Oh, and did I mention that Steve has won an Emmy for his documentary film 7 Days in September about the attacks of 9/11, and that he created the MTV show Unfiltered? Okay, I'm going to cut myself off now.
You're making me sound old.
No, I'm making you sound experienced and distinguished, hopefully.
All right, fair enough.
Steve, what important or interesting things about you did I miss, like perhaps some personal or the family side of you?
Well, I mean, you know, all those things sound fascinating, but the truth is, if you go back and look at my career, there have been kind of two consistent themes in them. One, I love content. I love making it. I love watching it. I love sharing it. And I also think that as the technology has gotten more deployed and more people have had iPhones in their pocket or, you know, flip cams in their vest pocket, the need to kind of change the way we gather and organize content has gone from being something that was kind of a nice to do to now, in the absence of good solutions, you know, the dirty secret that we all admit kind of amongst friends is we're just overwhelmed. We're overwhelmed with searching and having things come at us in an unfiltered manner, which, you know, given the fact that I made a show called that, is a little ironic. So I think that there is, for your listeners, a real change on the horizon of how things get to us. And I think you're going to see some very important new filters created. And I think some of your listeners may be out building them right now. So, you know, we'll have a good time and I'll share with you what I know. And hopefully we'll learn some stuff too.
Excellent. Well, I want to pause for a moment. I didn't extend a formal welcome from me and from the Smart and Simple Matters community, which I'll do right now. But I just want to give a little overview for the folks who are listening about what we'll be talking about and some of the benefits that they might get from it. I know that we can, of course, talk business and curating and entrepreneurship and a whole bunch of fun stuff, and we'll get to that. But I want to dive a little bit into your background first and maybe have you share a brief story about what your environment was like growing up. Then we'll discuss some of the foundational aspects of what it's like to be a curator and the act of curating. We'll chat, of course, about entrepreneurship and what you're doing, because I know you're doing a ton to help build a thriving entrepreneur scene in New York City and beyond. And depending on our time, we'll talk a little bit more about the curators that you respect, and we'll probably have a little bit of fun too. Maybe we'll compare your digital clothing to your physical clothing, something I picked up on in your TEDx talk. How's that sound, Steve?
I'm wearing physical clothing now, so and digital clothing as well.
All right. Hey, so am I. So that makes two of us. Well, to start us off, I'd like to take us back a number of years, or at least take you back a number of years. From what I've read about you, a big part of your personality and drive seems to come from the need to tell other people's stories in creative ways and with a heavy dose of context. Was there a big event or some kind of major mind shift when you were growing up that planted that seed in your head?
No, I come from a family of storytellers. My mom is an author and English teacher and professor, and my uncle was a journalist for many, many, many years. And kind of my whole family, you know, I grew up around the dining room table telling stories and listening to stories. You know, that's kind of deep in my DNA. And I also remember my mom for many years was an author. And so I tell people jokingly, I remember as a kid, the sound of the IBM Selectric typewriter clicking away in the background. Of course, that would be computer keys today. But I certainly grew up with this interest in storytelling. And in my last year in high school, I did a bunch of I thought I was going to be in the media business. And so I organized a bunch of internships. And maybe the one that was most critical for me was I was an intern at 60 Minutes when the extraordinary Don Hewitt was running it. And I remember having been there about 2 weeks, and there were all these 60-year-old white men running around with great passion and conviction about the stories they were telling. But they all looked like they came from the same part of the world and had the same color skin and the same worldview in one way or another. And they were all many, many, many years older than me. And I remember thinking at the time, it felt to me like the stories they were telling were not purposefully narrow, but ended up being narrow because of the life experience that they brought to that process. And so I left there thinking, all right, I don't want to work at 60 Minutes. I actually want to build an editorial shop in which the people who make the stories are much more diverse than that. And that was my first company, you know, right out of college, was a cable television production company in upstate New York, in which, you know, the people sitting around the producers meeting every week looked much younger than 60 Minutes and you know, much more diverse. Certainly many more women from the earliest days of the company, which 60 Minutes at that point, to my memory, had no women producers. And, you know, more diversity, you know, certainly much more diversity now than back then, but more diversity and more voices.
So what did that look like? Maybe you can paint a little mental picture for us. What was the feeling? Did you get the sense that you were a pioneer in a new landscape, or were you just trying to take something traditional and spin it in your own way where it felt a little less stale? Again, you were talking about these themes of telling stories and a lot of the background of your family. Can you give us a little bit of picture of what that was like?
Well, you know, the word entrepreneur gets thrown around a lot these days, right? I mean, there's hardly a meeting you go to or a blog you read or but back then it was that word. Again, spell check didn't know how to spell that word. So I don't think I thought of myself as building something or breaking ground or being a pioneer or any of those things. It was just, I knew I wanted to tell stories. I knew I wanted to reach audiences, and I knew I wanted to kind of do it on my own terms. And for a bunch of years, that was a really good gig. And then, you know, this was then, I'm going to try to remember now, like late 80s, mid to late 80s, a lot of television networks began doing news magazines in prime time, mostly because they were inexpensive. And this was the early days of Dateline, and there was a show called Now on NBC. And I began to feel like our show, the stories we were telling just weren't that different than the ones the network was telling, and that bothered me. And so I remember this very clearly. I was at a consumer electronics store, and I saw sitting on a shelf what was the very first digital view cam with a big LCD screen on the back. It was called a Sharp view cam, and it kind of looked like a lunchbox. Mm-hmm. But it recorded, you could point the camera ahead of you and look at yourself in a lens that flipped around. And I said, wow, this really is interesting, and reached out to someone in marketing at Sharp, and they loaned me five of these cameras. And we went on the air the next week, and we said, we're out of ideas. We don't know what stories to cover anymore, but we'd like you to tell us. And we put up an 800 number, and we said, you know, and if you have a story that we think's interesting, we're going to FedEx you a camera and loan that camera to you. And that changed everything overnight. We got 800 phone calls. People were desperate to tell their story that no one had ever asked them. I mean, that's the fascinating thing, right? I mean, and a reporter called me from the Associated Press and said, you know, what you're doing is really innovative technology. And I said, you know, much as I appreciate the compliment, we're not doing anything that the local TV stations couldn't do. We just answer the phone when it rings, and they don't. And, you know, the idea of listening, of not being afraid of the audience, and of not being afraid of storytellers, has been a theme in my life.
Well, that's great, and maybe you can tie that theme into us. Let's fast forward to the past decade or more current times here. And I, in my introduction of you, hopefully I gave people an idea of all the stuff that you've been doing recently. I know you've been working on a lot of cool creations for a long time. Now, we're going to be talking a lot about curating today, and I probably define it a little bit differently than most folks. I'm curious to know how you define it, and maybe if my definition resonates with you. I'll give you my brief definition here.
Go ahead.
So I define it as the act of intentionally sifting through your experiences and what you consume, categorizing and archiving the best stuff, and making it accessible and shareable for not just your future benefit, but for the use of others. How do you view curating? Is it similar to what I do from a personal perspective, or does it take on a little bit of a different tone?
No, I mean, I would only add one thing to your definition, which is that I think there's a class of curators that adds context, whether it be in their own, you know, writing intros, kind of describing collections. But let's step back a second. There's a reason why curation came to be. And that is first and foremost because creation became so damn easy, right? I mean, in the early days of Google, search worked because everything that people were searching for, the people who were making web content that was searchable were in some way, shape, or form professionals. They were either magazines or they were government agencies or they were institutions or they were museums. But everything that Google had at its disposal was reasonably high quality. And so the results of their searches were reasonably high quality. Blogs came along, but even there, you know, Google seemed to be able to manage how to kind of separate out content from, you know, from blogs. Now, in the new kind of world of the real-time web, most of these search algorithms just fall over. They just don't know what to do. And, you know, if something happens in the world, you know, yesterday, you know, Hillary Clinton speaks in front of, Congress, and literally the Twitter sphere lights up. Well, if you're Google, how do you filter that? And so curation is a new behavior that says, in a world of unlimited content, I don't need to know, and I'm not a fan of words like the best, right? I'm not saying you need the best tweets or the best video, but I may decide, you know what? I really like Joel's take on the world of social media. And so when he tells me there are 10 things a day that I need to check out, I'm going to trust that he and I are close enough in our interests, and he challenges my beliefs in some interesting ways. Now, if over time you disappoint the hell out of me, and I really don't like your curatorial take, there will be other people that I can choose to kind of accept as trusted sources. But for lots of your listeners, I think the real future of curation may not be being a curator as much as it is finding curators to trust.
Right.
Knowing that we're not all responsible for waking up every morning and standing in front of the fire hose of the web, and each of us has to pluck out of this same information stream the 30 things that we care about in a day. And so, I mean, one of the things that I believe passionately about, and I think it fits your blog and also your worldview, is I think that people actually don't want more information. They actually want less.
I would think you're right on that. I'm a little bit different. I take it as a challenge every single day of not just how much can I consume, but how do I turn this fire hose, as you put it, into something useful? How can I turn that into a trickle and be able to drip that on people in various ways and make it useful and provide the context on top of it, an additional layer besides the original source? And one of the things that I struggle with, I'm curious to hear your take on it, there seems to be this philosophy. I mean, on one hand, we're supposed to go where our audience or community wants to hang out. You do a ton of video, so I'm sure you hang out on a lot of places where video is created or curated. That's not necessarily our home base, like our business website or our personal blog. So I've heard lots of people say you need to be active on Facebook and Pinterest, Tumblr, Scoop It, a whole host of other websites. But to me, casting this net so wide is at odds with some of the massive benefits that curating can provide for simplifying and organizing our lives. What do you think about that? Are there certain principles a curator can develop to avoid overwhelming ourselves with various platforms while we seek to help others avoid the overwhelm of all this unfiltered content?
So let's define curation a little bit more narrowly. You know, I might be a curator of things going on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I might say, you know what, for people who have kids my kids' age who live near me, I'm going to share on Facebook the great things to do this weekend, free or low cost. And that might become a fun thing for me to share with my friends and my neighbors. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to be the curator of movies or music or so I think that part of I don't think that you're either a curator or you're not. I think that increasingly what's going to happen is you're going to find the thing that you're passionate about that you want to help your friends and neighbors organize, and you're going to start to find other people to help you in the areas where you maybe don't have as much time. And part of it is, you know, both you and I work in technology and social media, but for someone who's got a day job, you know, behind the counter at a bank, that fire hose, you know, how many hours a day, Joel, do you spend curating?
Boy, you're putting me on the spot here. I would say probably 2.5 to 3 hours. But it's not just what I consume online. It's also the experiences that I have. Some of the listeners know I have a terrible memory, horrible memory, which is why I've jerry-rigged a series of spreadsheets that operates as an external memory where I can curate all these different experiences. A lot of people I know wouldn't spend that amount of time to do it, but I find it fun and I find it worthwhile. What about you? How much time would you say that you spend?
So it's a good question. I'm online virtually from the moment I wake up until the moment I, you know, shut off the lights. And I curate kind of all the time. I'm always reading Twitter. Now, I've got Twitter set up so it searches for keywords I care about. So I'm not looking at the raw feed of Twitter. I'm looking at a Twitter subset which has keywords like, you know, curation. So when I look at the feed of curation, there are literally thousands of tweets a day with that keyword in it. I may retweet 6 or 8 of them. That's it. You know, now, some of it's just some human editing. The word curate has a religious connotation, so I have to edit out anything that, you know, doesn't mean curation the way I or museums or whatever. But then some of it's also I'm looking for unusual, interesting people that are maybe not mainstream journalists but are saying something that I think people caring about curation will be interested in.
That makes a ton of sense. But I would imagine Twitter is just one of the tools that you use. There are probably a number of other tools that you use on an ongoing basis.
Without a doubt. So certainly Facebook all day long, certainly LinkedIn all day long, certainly, you know, Google News Alerts, you know, and then, you know, and it goes on and on. I mean, Pinterest, not so much yet. Tumblr to some extent, but not as much as I'd like. But again, what I don't want to do is scare away your listeners. I mean, there's a difference between being a professional curator, which is a business lifestyle decision, and being somebody that's overwhelmed with content and hoping that this avalanche is going to slow down. And that's, I think, the thing that I'm most passionate about, which is, you know, I give a public talk, and one of the questions I always ask is, how many people in the audience have gotten up at least once in the last 3 months to check their email in the middle of the night? And when I started asking that question 18 months ago, it was like 20%, and they raised their hand sheepishly. And then 6 months ago, it was like 40%. And then I just did it at Disney. I asked that question in front of a room of 900 people, and it was about 80%. Wow. Well, that's not a good thing. Like, I don't put that in the good news category. If we're all now literally bailing, you know, like we're literally sitting in the rowboat bailing as fast as we can because, you know, our emails overflowing and our inboxes, you know, can't be managed. You know, it really is time for a change in behavior and a change in technology.
Yeah, and don't worry about scaring my listeners away. If they were the types that get frightened easily, I would have already done it a while ago. So you're good there. But did I hear you right? 80% of people will check their email in the middle of the night, basically sometime between their head hits the pillow and when their head gets up from the pillow?
Yeah.
That is insane.
Now, this was a room of technologists, so... You know, but look, and when you ask people why they do it, they all have an excuse. Well, I have an overseas client who emails me, or, you know, I'm dealing with a project and I've got a vendor who's working on it and I need to, you know, there's always a reason why people think it's okay to have to be on 24/7, you know, but then you don't get a good night's sleep. And, you know, I always tell people, my answer to that is no one ever sends you good news at 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's true. But what if they're on the other side of the world?
Well, then you got to figure out a schedule. That's a business problem. But I'm saying if you're literally just getting all twitchy at 3 a.m. and have to go check your email, what you're going to find is, you know, something broke and it can wait till morning.
Yeah. Well, I want to take this back for a moment. You were talking about business and entrepreneurs, and I want to be able to make sure that you get a chance to talk about your business and the fact that you're the CEO of Magnify.net and a lot of the really cool things that you're doing with video. But first, at least from entrepreneurs, a lot of the folks who listen to the show are or would like to be them. And they're probably like me, where they struggle to tell their story, whether it's their personal story or their business story, in some kind of concise and powerful way. How do you help people, whether it's in small businesses like me, tell their story through video, curating, some kind of specific outreach strategy? What do you do?
So let's talk about that. The first thing is, you know, one of the things people learn about video is they, you know, somebody's got a blog and they get all excited. They go, I'm going to add video. And they think they're going to do a video a week or a video 3 times a week. And they're in their head, they say, well, I'm going to do a 3-minute video. I'll put aside an hour to make it. I'll take an hour and I'll make one. And 3 hours later, they're like, man, this is like, I had to set up lights. I had to get the microphone hooked up. The backdrop wasn't right. I had to get a teleprompter. I recorded it. I needed to edit it, whatever. And when they're done, in their head, they get this, you see in their face, this their face drops. And they realize that to do 3 videos a week at 3 hours of video is 9 hours for, and when they're done, they'll have 3 videos on their website. And they're like, you know what? I can't do it. I can't keep up with this volume of content that I think I should be making, and then they give up. And so Magnify comes in and says, wait a minute. So I'll give you an example of this. There's a website called Clinical Advisor. It's a medical professional website for nurse practitioners and home health aides. They were going to make video, and they had exactly that experience that I just described to you, which is it was going to cost them in time and dollars way more than it was worth to make the what they thought they needed, which was literally 300-400 videos a week. And then they had this revelation, which is in the medical issues that they cover, you know, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, the web is awash with this content. There's no shortage of videos about diabetes and, you know, how to insulin pumps and medication and, you know, innovation around. There's no shortage of that.
Sure.
In fact, there's way too much of it. And if you go to YouTube and type in diabetes, you get 10,000 results. Well, no human being wants to consume that. So the editors at Clinical Advisor said, you know what? We're going to take these categories. We're going to take our trained medical professionals, and we're going to post 10 videos a week. We're going to filter through all of the noise, and we're going to tell our visitors, here's very high-quality video from a handful of sources. So that's what they did.
Do you have other examples of people who are doing something powerful like that, who use your platform?
Hundreds. Hundreds. So the service has 90,000 sites. And some of them are big brands, you know, like New York Magazine and Vibe and Taste of Home, which is a Reader's Digest cooking site. And some of them are lots of little mom and pops you've never heard of. But fundamentally, the passion that we have for the service is the thing that you're able to do. And here's a good example, right? So let's bring it back to you, Joel. So if I use Magnify, what would be the keywords that you would start a search on? Simplify your life, simplicity, real simple, you know, right? Some set of, and you would literally get, based on those relatively broad terms, thousands of results. But you would be able to look at those thumbnails and the and the taglines and very quickly go, this guy, he's a huckster. I don't like him. He's selling some service that I don't, you know, I'm never going to post his videos. This, you know, there's, you know, but these people, this institution, this group, this philosophy, I really actually, they totally vibe with me. My readers are really going to like what they have to say. And you can then set the system up to say, here's sources I trust. Here's sources Joel trusts. They can get live on my site without having to go to me. And here's other keyword searches where I want to get alerted when these videos go live because I want to look at them and make a judgment call. No algorithm in the world is going to replace Joel. Of that, I am absolutely sure.
Well, I'm flattered. Thank you for saying that. And thank you for using me as an example. I would hope that people...
But by the way...
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. But that wasn't always true. You know, there was a period of time not very long ago when people, I think, really believed that the algorithm was going to, you know, replace humans and that Google News was going to be effective at finding everything you needed and the idea of human editors and human filters was going to go away. And, you know, so it's only in the last 12 months, 24 months that I think we've determined that we need humans.
Yeah, the human element has always been essential and I think will continue to be essential. Even if robots run the world someday, I'm pretty sure that you're still going to need humans in one way or another to make sense of some things that artificial intelligence and algorithms just simply can't do. And one of the comments that you just made there in terms of who the curators are, and maybe that's not the right question, I wanted to ask you, you wrote a great article in 2010 for Mashable called Why Content Curation is Here to Stay. I'm going to link to it in the show notes a lot, along with a lot of the other resources that you've had here. You asked a lot of great questions about who's adding the real value. Is it the people who are allowing you to find something? Is it the people who are content makers or the curators and publishers? I'm wondering, where does the balance of power shift or where does it currently stand in your eyes between the curators and the creators of content?
So it's a great question and it's not simple to answer. So I'll give you a couple of examples. I blog a lot. And, you know, for a period of time, I had my own blog, but I also blogged for, you know, Forbes.com and occasionally Huffington Post and occasionally Mashable. What I came to realize was that what those guys had done, each of them in different ways, they did the hard part. They aggregated a great big audience. And so if you look at Huffington, you know, they certainly produce some original content. But I think, and I don't know this for a fact, but my guess is that probably 20% of what's on Huffington Post is created by them, and the balance is either contributed by, you know, bloggers or aggregated from the web. But they're a fire hose of traffic. And so, you know, I think that on balance, while I add value there and I appreciate that they give me a platform, I think that they deserve the lion's share of the revenue because they're doing the hard part, which is publishing to an audience. That's so, but it's not always true. YouTube right now is internally, and they've talked about this with me for a post I wrote, they're really trying to rethink revenue share around how much does the creator get, how much does the platform get, and how much does the curator get. And not very long ago, the curator would have been thought of as zero, but that's, I think, changing.
So what does YouTube, or what do you think in terms of, it's not easy if you have three parties that are involved in the process, and there's always, almost always more than a lot than three parties involved. Is this some kind of a 50, 30, 20 kind of breakdown, or how important it is for the people who consume everything to be able to get the context, to be able to have that trusted source or number of sources that they can go to? How do you put a price tag on something like that?
I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all answer. So if you're Lady Gaga, you're going to get the bulk of the value. YouTube's going to take something, but she's going to have a lot of negotiating leverage. And the teenage boy or girl in their room who puts Lady Gaga's video on their homepage is probably getting zero. They're probably getting to be able to put Lady Gaga on their blog or on their Tumblr page, and that's probably it. On the other hand, if you're Huffington and you've got all this traffic, then the person creating the content, and even if these people are well-known public figures and, you know, excellent writers, you know, there's a supply and demand pivot here that I don't think is really, I don't think it's going to be as simple as a third, a third, a third. Like, I think we'd all like it to be a formula, but I think in real life, it's going to be a negotiation.
Yeah, I'm interested in seeing how that evolves. And I will be checking out your stuff since you're at the forefront of these kinds of things. And because you're at the forefront of a lot of these things and your mindset and the evolution of how you perceive information coming at us and what to do with it is pretty advanced, I'm curious to know who your main people are. Who are the folks in your mind who are just rocking the curating world that you follow, and what makes them so awesome?
So I generally don't like to endorse people because I think I inevitably hurt somebody's feelings, but I can give you an example of someone that I think you'll find really useful. There's a site called Media Redefined, and the person who runs it is Jason Hirschhorn. He was formerly the president of MySpace. Media Redefined is a daily newsletter. I don't fully understand how he possibly does it. It seems to me that he probably doesn't sleep much. He must read 500 things a day. Part of what he's done for me is I now find that I don't need to read nearly as much, because he does a very effective job of finding the things that matter. Now, do we agree on everything? No, we don't. Does he put some things in his collections that I find totally uninteresting? Absolutely. But when you get, and his newsletter's free, comes every day, and I don't think he's, since I've known him, which is now a fairly long time, I don't think he's ever missed a day. I don't think he's, I don't even know how he does it. I mean, he was at Sundance, essentially, watching movies night and day and tweeting about them. And, that was yesterday, and now he's back in New York, and the newsletter came out at 10 a.m., without missing a beat.
I would love to know what his workflow looks like. Yeah. Maybe I'll have a chat with him someday about that. Yeah, and I wasn't looking for some kind of exhaustive list of your top five people, but giving people an example in terms of what they're doing. Other folks might be more familiar with it sounds like he almost has a brain pickings type flavor to him, only he's doing it weekly as opposed to, say, as opposed to a weekly letter. Although Maria Popova is doing tons of stuff on her website daily.
So he loves her. They're like pals. And he currently uses FeedBurner, but I think you'll see a change kind of down the road. I know he's been looking at some other platforms, but, it's a behavior that didn't exist, 2 years ago. So everyone's making it up as they go along.
Yeah. Well, this has been a really cool chat so far, Steve, and I promised you and everyone else listening a little bit of fun at the top of the show, and I want to make sure that I can deliver on that. We were talking about digital clothes and physical clothes, and in your TEDx, you were talking about choosing your digital clothing carefully, and by that, of course, correct me if I'm wrong, since you're here and I've got the horse's mouth here who can tell us if I'm misinterpreting, it sounded like you mean everything that you endorse, whether it's directly through something like an Amazon review or indirectly through clicking a Facebook like button. It should be carefully weighed against whether the action will bring meaning and value to someone else. So you choose your digital clothing very carefully. How precise are you with your physical clothing compared to the suit that you wear online?
Pretty precise. I think in a world in which we're increasingly making judgments faster, you want people's first judgment to be, hey, this guy's interesting, or, put together, or sharp, or whatever, and not slovenly. And I feel that way about my retweets, just as I do about, keeping my shoes shined. So.
All right. Good to know you're just as snappy offline as you are online.
One hopes. Hey, listen, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it has. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you'd like people to know?
There's currently a little bit of a backlash around the word curation because it's being used, we're curating a dinner party or we're curating a collection of movies to watch this weekend. And I really think that we collectively have an obligation to kind of make sure the word has meaning and not let it become turned into a lazy marketing phrase. And so whenever somebody says to me, oh, we use automated curation or we use algorithmic curation, I always that's like fighting words to me, because robots don't curate. Robots don't write music. They don't write poetry. They don't write plays. They don't, you know, they don't design, you know, they don't paint pictures. They're not artists. And they don't choose sophisticated, interesting collections of ideas. And if we allow the word to be diluted into being simply kind of a highfalutin word for organize, that would be a shame.
Hmm. Well, people can read more about that in your book, which I'm going to tout here. I'm going to link to that in the show notes here, along with some of the other resources that you've created, your magnify.net website and Curation Nation and some of the other folks. I would highly, highly recommend that the people who are going to be checking out the show notes who have listened to that, spend some time and pay attention to you. You have a lot of great things to say, and I can see the trajectory of where you're going is going to be very cool too.
And follow me on Twitter, at Magnify.
Boom.
I take it pretty seriously.
At Magnify. He does, everybody. I tweeted him, and this is how this conversation got started. He was very responsive, and he's got some cool stuff going on there. Now, I just want to tell everybody from my personal perspective for a moment here, if you didn't listen to the initial episode on curating in this ongoing series about the topic, go to valueofsimple.com/SASM005 to hear a relatively brief, at least for my standards, but it's an intro on all things curating. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the curating series in a comment on the show notes for this episode at valueofsimple.com/SASM013. In a review of the show on iTunes, in your own blog post about the topic, wherever, anywhere you want to add to the conversation, just make sure you do it, and I'm sure you will, in a way that doesn't add to the noise in an already very busy internet. So, Steve, thank you once again for joining me today. It's been a real treat.
Absolutely, Joel. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zaslavsky, creator of all things Value of Simple.